Hello, everyone, and welcome to Food Safety Matters, the podcast for food safety professionals. I'm Stacey Acheson, publisher of Food Safety Magazine, and I'm here with my co-host, Barbara Van Renterham, editorial director of Food Safety Magazine, and a very special guest, Larry Keener, president and CEO of International Product Safety Consultants, who's joining us to share perspectives on the 10th anniversary of the Food Safety Modernization Act, or FSMA. So welcome, Larry, and Happy New Year to both of you. Woohoo!
Thank you.
2021.
It is indeed. Thank you, Stacey. Thanks for having me.
Yes, well, thank you for making the time, Larry. We always appreciate it, and very happy that you could join us for this one. So before we get started, I'd like to give Larry a proper introduction. Larry has more than 30 years' experience in the food processing industry, holding positions in private industry with the state of California and with the National Processors Association. Larry's an internationally regarded process authority and frequently works with food companies in this capacity to communicate the processor's regulatory responsibilities, assess risk, and adequacy of controls for entire processing operations. Mr. Keener is vice president and co-chair of the Austrian-based Global Harmonization Initiative, or GHI, an organization founded in 2004 to promote harmonization of food safety legislation and regulation. He has written many papers and book chapters on food safety and process validation, and is a frequently invited speaker to food industry, business and scientific conferences, workshops, and seminars. And Larry's a fellow of the Institute of Food Technologists. And most importantly, Larry is one of the longest-serving members of the Food Safety Magazine Editorial Advisory Board, as well as serving as the chairman of the Food Safety Magazine Distinguished Service Award Committee. Larry has also been somewhat of a regular guest on our podcast. You'll want to check out Episode 2 and Episode 20. And I also think there's another special segment in there somewhere, too. We're going to start with FSMA. On January 4th in 2011, the Food Safety Modernization Act was signed into law. It was the largest overhaul of the nation's food safety system since the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act of 1938. And yes, your math, if you're able to do it in your head, I'm not so good at that, but maybe you are. If you're doing it, 73 years is right. That is a long, long time. So it was landmark legislation. So the intention of FSMA was to move to a preventive model for food safety and is comprised of seven foundational rules: preventive controls for human food, preventive controls for animal food, produce safety, foreign supplier verification program, third-party audit certification, food defense, intentional adulteration, and sanitary transportation. So admittedly, this is a huge topic. I mean, right? It took 73 years to get to it. So, and we could probably speak about this for the next 10 years, but we're going to try and shoot for something a little shorter than that. We're going to focus on a few key points. One, the most significant impacts of FSMA. Two, what are the remaining gaps? And finally, has FSMA reduced outbreaks of foodborne illness? And there might be a few other things that come up as we go along because, you know, we're freewheeling here. So first, Larry, I want to thank you again for joining us. And I guess just get started because on the significant impacts of FSMA. So let's start with you, Larry. I mean, when I called you the other day, you immediately jumped to where I knew you might. but what do you think are the most significant impacts of FSMA?
Thanks, Stacey and Barbara, again, for the invitation to join this discussion. It's hard to believe, actually, that it's been 10 years already. But the fact of the matter is, it has been 10 years. And thinking about this topic and thinking about your initial comments about 73 years, it occurred to me that as the habits of the beast, food safety, change, so too must our strategy to contain it. So since 1938, we've not had much of a shift in the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act insofar as it relates to codifying rules and regulations relating to food safety. In 1986, with the update of the GMP regulations, we made a step in the right direction by including in the definitions of that update the simple notion of a critical control point. Mm-hmm. I think that event in 1986 is also worthy of mentioning, because it actually kind of charted a course forward that culminated with the Obama administration passing the Food Safety Modernization Act. So this is overdue. The beast has changed. I gave a presentation in 1990 to the Nutmeg section of the IFT, and that presentation dealt with emerging pathogens. So we were talking about E. coli 015787, the verotoxigenic and the sugar toxigenic strains of E. coli, and there was some paucity in the literature about whether they were or were not human pathogens. We were really confirming the status of Listeria monocytogenes. We had a whole raft of organisms back then that were under discussion that we now know are human pathogens. So, two, then our strategies to deal with these newly recognized human pathogens had to change. The beast had changed, and we needed to change our strategies. So changing that strategy then involved HACCP. HACCP was a great introduction to the principles, the fundamental guiding principles that underlie food or underpin food safety assurance. A critical control point, critical limits, monitoring, verification, and validation. So these are the fundamentals of food safety, and these were rolled out starting, say, 1986 to the industry. And you will notice that in the FSMA regulations for preventive controls, that HACCP and the updated GMPs are the predicate for food safety going forward. This is the new definition of food safety. So it's intended to be proactive. It intends that we use scientific methods, including validation. So if we go back again to 1986 and we say that the government codified critical control point, it's always been interesting to me that they did not define in that same update critical limits, because it is to the critical limits that the operation and the function of the critical control point is defined. And the only way that we can have critical limits is through the process called validation. In 1986, the food side, CIFSAN, did not have a codified definition for validation. There was a very eloquent and appropriate definition for validation on the medical devices side of the agency. And for many, many years, I have personally used that definition when talking about validation. And I think it's a good one. I think the agency and writing FSMA and providing a definition for validation, I think they did a pretty good job. It's focused on the food safety plan, rather than conventional focus on specified outcomes. But so the impact of FSMA, then has in my mind been to increase our understanding of what food safety is. So we talk about that and we call that capacity building. Mm-hmm. So capacity building across the supply chains, our supply chain partners in Asia, our supply chain partners in Africa and South America. One of the collateral benefits of FSMA is to cause capacity building in those nations about what food safety is. So we know that the international regulatory schemes for food safety are discordant. And therefore, we have discordant expectations, don't we, as to mm-hmm. what food safety is. What is a safe food? That's unfortunately, that's debated. And so I think with FSMA and the United States taking this unilateral action to promulgate and project these regulations onto our supply chain partners, causing them to build regulatory capacity, scientific capacity insofar as it relates to food safety, laboratory and testing capacity necessary for supporting monitoring of critical control points attending to the critical limits attending to a critical control point in the process. I think for my money, this is the big win for FSMA and let's be clear, the victory is not at hand yet. I think the stage is set. The groundwork has been prepared, but we still have work to do. So capacity building, understanding both in the United States and with our supply chain partners what food safety is and what food safety is not, is to my mind the big win, the big win for FSMA.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Those thoughts are really aligned with the thoughts of Frank Yannis. I reached out to Frank at FDA and asked him this very question. And Frank really takes the 20,000 foot view in his position there. And he agrees that FSMA has really resulted in a bigger conversation with all stakeholders about the importance of food safety. And like you're saying, Larry, really getting to the meat of it's part of the dialogue now. We're seeing it in Congress. We follow some of our representatives and the work that they're doing. We've talked about on the podcast. We're seeing it in the normal press much more than ever before. It's really become a very common dialogue. At the other point that Frank made to me was that specifically through the finalization of these rules that Stacy mentioned, that those who grow, produce, pack, hold, import, and transport food are now taking the steps needed every day to reduce the risk of contamination of their food products. So, your thoughts are very much aligned with those of.
Well, they're expected to.
that's true. But we've always had that expectation. 402A of the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act, as it was promulgated in 1938, prepared, packed, or held under conditions whereby it is rendered injurious to the health. We've always had that expectation. But I think FSMA dials it in, gives us more granularity. There's the specificity in the seven fundamental tenets of the FSMA are important. I mean, let's take, for example, if I can, the foreign supplier verification. So having spent much of my career working with the big multinational corporations, foreign supplier verification programs are old hat. We've been doing that for a very long time. Because when we understood that when we project our supply chains into new areas where we, where we might get an economic benefit, where we might get a new raw material that give us an advantage in the marketplace. Well, we understood that there was some inherent risk, right? Risk assessment underpins FSMA. So we understood that there were these risks that were not properly identified, that were not properly, where there were not countermeasures deployed to defend against them. So I've been on every continent on the planet except for Antarctica, putting together foreign supplier verification programs before they were codified in the FSMA. However, the agency taking the time to be deliberate in codifying language around foreign supplier verification programs is a great, great thing. It's a great win for the global supply chains, for the global food processing industry. That expectation hasn't always been there for the small and medium-sized companies.
Yes. We also reached out to Kathy Gombas, a food safety consultant at FSMA Implementation Solutions, and who was formerly the senior advisor for FSMA implementation at FDA CIFSAN, actually. But and she wrote in her comments about the fact that for the medium to small firms, Larry, what you're pointing to here is about capacity building, and that the smaller firms and the medium firms are really struggling, not just to just understand what a plan is, to write a plan, let alone to implement a plan. I think FSMA is still, aspirational for a lot of firms to really get their heads around.
I wanted to point out another comment that Kathy made that I thought that was really interesting, because she thought another question that maybe I should have asked her was the impact of FSMA on FDA regulators. And as a former regulator, this was, obvious to her, but I didn't think of it. But from the time that the rollout of these rules was going on, and FDA was very deliberate because they knew that there was a little catch up on the part of companies to really understand the regulations, that their mantra was they would educate while they regulate. So there was a shift in the mindset and the culture at FDA at all levels. And she said that FDA was focused on converting inspections to be system-based versus observational-based. And so she's heard from a lot of current inspectors who felt like they were being asked to be industry consultants versus enforcing rules. So this was a very big cultural shift at FDA. So that, in her mind, mm-hmm. was one of the main impacts of FSMA. You know, just to be transparent, I also reached out to Steve Mondernach from the Association of Food and Drug Officials and David Acheson with his own company, the Acheson Group. David, of course, was instrumental in rolling out FSMA at FDA when he was there. And both Steve and David mentioned, as you mentioned, Larry, supply chain, of impact on the supply chain and risk control. And also the whole nature of, and Stacey and I talked about this earlier this week, FSMA was really broadcast as a means to prevent outbreaks as opposed to reacting to outbreaks. But as we see, you can't anticipate everything that's going to happen. So we're never going to 100% get away from that reactive mindset. Although I think the changes that have been put in place, we are catching things earlier before they can cause illness. So just wanted to throw those comments out there too.
If I can jump in here back again on the supply chains and especially the inbound supply chains, I wrote a paper back in 2013 with Tatiana Kuchma up in Canada about FSMA and a comparable piece of legislation in Canada, Safe Foods Canadians and the Safe Foods Canadians Act. And I recall Margaret Hamburg from FDA at the time pointing out that in 2013 there were 24 million discrete shipments of food arriving into the United States through 300 of its various ports. And of that 24 million discrete shipments, less than 1.5% of that food was subject to hands-on FDA inspection. So yes, Barbara, that shift to systems versus observation was necessary. The agency had to do that because there was no way that we were going to keep up. That 24 million shipments in 2013, by the way, was expected within 5 years to double. So in 2018, one would speculate that there were perhaps 48 million discrete shipments coming into 300 ports. And I don't think that we've increased FDA staff that would make a difference in the number of actual inspections. So this was, again, another benefit of the FSMA strategy.
The only other comment, and this is one that Steve made, he points to specific FSMA regulations that he thinks have had the greatest impact. And the one that you spoke to, Larry, is the preventive controls rules. But he also mentioned about the expectations and regulatory structure around produce. Those have, in his mind, at least from a state level, as he's been involved talking to growers across the country, that those have had the greatest impact. He didn't get down in the weeds about that. He did mention about implementation of preventive controls, but it's an ongoing it's an ongoing process. And like Kathy had mentioned, the small to medium sized firms are still challenged. And I have to think that some of that is a resource issue.
Yeah, I think I want to jump in a little bit here, because in Frank's letter that he put out from FDA, he talks about the water regulations as they relate to produce, and the fact that there was, you know, comments and so much discussion with industry, and, you know, putting it forth as a very positive thing that government listened to industry when it came to the water regulations. And while, you know, on its face, I would say, oh, that's a good thing. It's, you know, it's important to have dialogue. At the same time, those regulations were put forth. There was pushback. There was, you know, extension. And then we've had what we've had, which is, you know, how many numbers of outbreaks related to produce, related to water. And it just made me kind of, you know, do that kind of crooked dog listening to high-pitched sound, like, really? Okay. I don't know. So is that a gap? Is that, they were clearly onto something when they wrote the regulation, if we can just get to it.
No, I don't think it's a gap. So what we have to understand about the FSMA is that it is evolutionary. This regulation is evolving, and it will need to evolve. It will need to evolve. The produce one is an excellent one when we go back and look at it, because I mean we had a need, the big spinach outbreak, and I guess that was around 2000 or so. Kind of got everybody's attention.
Yes.
and begged the question about that segment of the supply chain. What the safety and the integrity of that portion of the supply mm-hmm. chain. What were we doing wrong that allowed that kind of a massive contamination event? And so sitting down in 2011 with Jenny and the team and writing these regulations, well, of course, this is top of mind. So we were going to do the best that we could to try and erect a regulatory structure or framework around produce, and the produce rule evolved. And, well, what's a farm? What's on farm activity?
Still to be defined.
All of these questions. So is a packing shed on a farm a food production facility, or is it an integral part of the farm? Is a mechanical harvester in a tomato field? is that harvester a processing facility, or is it a device for collecting the fruit? These kinds of things need to be sorted out. That they need to be discussed. Some determinations made, and then once we've done that, then we can start to talk about preventive controls. So that's my point is that these regulations are evolutionary. They've done the best they could with the first cut, but I tell everybody all the time, and I tell CEOs this most often, that food safety is dynamic, and I say that to them most often, because they will say that we've invested this much and we've built a HACCP plan and we've built a food safety team. But the fact of the matter is, food safety is not static. It's a dynamic. Mm-hmm. It continues to change. And as it continues to change, we need to continue to invest. we need to continue to learn. We need to continue to educate. We need to continue to refine our approach to prevention and control of the hazards as they are identified.
You know, when you first mentioned evolutionary, I thought, oh, like the Constitution, a living document. And Kathy's comments actually...
Or suggestion.
Well, Kathy mentioned that she was on the FSMA Implementation Steering Committee, and they identified three phases of the implementation. The first was to set the standards, to write the regulations. The second phase was to design strategies to promote and oversee industry compliance. The last phase was to implement, monitor, evaluate, and refresh. And that is to identify performance metrics to measure success. And she hasn't really seen a whole lot of phase three being done. And I think that, you know, going forward, as you're saying, Larry, we do need to reevaluate. And that's why some of these components of the produce rule keep undergoing repeated iterations, especially in light of all the issues we've seen with romaine. And it, you know, one, we haven't yet gotten to the second question, but I think that there are things that FDA didn't foresee when they wrote these regulations. Mm-hmm. And I think that plays into your part of the discussion that this is an evolving type of document. So
then maybe let's get to the second question. See, it's a good thing it's a 10-year retrospective, right? So what are the remaining gaps? I mean, I guess if it is an evolution. So anyway, gaps. Are there gaps, or is this a process rather than an event?
it's absolutely a process. And the 2011 regulations are the jumping off point. They're the starting point. And again, the using the produce rules that clearly shows that we need to be open to change, and we need to be open to understanding that we don't know what we don't know, and that there are some learnings, and we continue to learn about food safety, and so other gaps. I mean, one of the gaps, Stacy, and I think you over the years you and I have talked about this. I always thought that, and I've written for you that transportation was the squeaky wheel of the food safety mm-hmm. system. Well, here we are in 2021, and I would go back and I would refresh that article, and I'd ask you to publish it again, because I still think that the gap in the food safety system is transportation. Once the food leaves a highly regulated operational facility with all of the preventive control measures, a valid food safety plan, we hand it off to planes, boats, ships, trucks, pickup trucks, donkeys,
storage units.
it goes into that transportation system, and for the life of me, I have, even with the FDA shifting to a systems-based approach to inspection and enforcement, I see great difficulty with implementation and enforcement of this aspect of the supply chain, and I think therefore that this is a gap, and so let me put a fine point on it. So much of my concern is about perishable foods in the cold chain. So when we take the food from a well-regulated, high-performance food production establishment, and we offer it into refrigerated distribution, we know, and we have good data that the food is almost immediately subjected to abuse, temperature abuse, and whereby there is an increased potential for the outgrowth of undesirable and or pathogenic microorganisms. So this is the gap for me, transportation and the cold chain.
Interesting.
Do you think that the with the new era of smarter food safety, with the emphasis on technology and traceability and some of those things, that some of that will get addressed as we leverage more technology and pay attention there?
Yeah, I think it will help. More information will lead to corrections and preventive control measures. So right now, there is a paucity of information. Once that material goes into the supply chain, it can lose its identity, it can lose its history, and certainly we don't have good information about how it's been handled, stored, whether it's been subjected to temperature abuse or not. So when anything that we can do, the smart food safety, artificial intelligence, all of those things that we can bring to bear on shining a brighter light on the history of the food in the distribution system is going to enable improvement.
Now, what I found interesting, so I have my own gap that I'll end this discussion with before we move on to question three. But I wanted to mention a few of the gaps described to me by the folks I reached out to. Retail and food service was a huge gap. David Acheson and Steve Mondernach both specifically mentioned retail foods. Now, retail is addressed in the new era of smarter food safety blueprint. Now, David also mentioned about tracking and traceability. Frank mentioned that, as you said, Larry, that essentially food production is constantly evolving, as are the pathogens that cause contamination. So he wanted to express some of the rulemakings that are in process through FDA, and maybe I'll put this in some kind of document that we can post in the show notes. So food traceability, we've done a lot recently and posted on our website about the work that FDA is doing in food traceability.
The proposed rule.
And the ag water standards that we've mentioned already, since mm-hmm. you brought that up, that was another one. Definition of a farm, exactly to your point, Larry. And also, and this is also in the blueprint, is lab accreditation and kind of moving that forward. Now, Kathy went a little bit outside and said guidance and outreach, you know, from the regulatory perspective. So she said for the preventive controls for human foods, FDA's only published a few draft chapters of the hazard guide, and the industry continually asks when FDA is going to provide additional guidance. So on food allergens, sanitation, environmental monitoring. And she also brings up retailers. So, like you mentioned, Larry, is that shed on the farm a processing establishment, and are they subjected to the PC rule as opposed to produce? She said some retailers who think they're under the food code are now realizing that they may also do manufacturing, processing, and repacking, and that makes them fall under the PC rule. So there's a lot of crosstalk between these rules that companies may not understand that they're subjected to regulations by multiple components of the rule. And so I think a big gap for Kathy is just kind of connecting the dots with companies and firms and identifying exactly what rules they need to be in compliance with. My personal gap, and it's something that I've talked to people about in the past, is the whole nature that there are companies that produce food that are exempt. I understand that they created exemptions because of, you know, for small, very small companies or cottage food industry that was so small that they didn't have the resources. But to think that anybody would be exempt from the very basics of food safety, I think is one of the biggest gaps. I go into my grocery store and I see that they're selling products from local farms. And I think, who's taking the responsibility for this? Are these, you know, very small local establishments regulated in some point? You know, I'm buying it at a grocery store that spans two or three states. Who's responsible ultimately? And I don't buy those things, but I wonder about that. But the exemption part of FSMA, I think, is a huge gap.
Well, and I think then all of a sudden you start hearing about botulism. It's like, yeah. I mean, really? In 2021, yeah. We're hearing about botulism, but I don't think it's from a major manufacturer.
So, Barbara, that's an interesting point that you make. And so it's a question that I've asked, a bigger question I've asked about the FSMA. So historically, we have operated in the United States, at least, under the assumption that the responsibility for food safety resides with those companies that manufacture and market an article of food. That food safety is not the responsibility of the regulatory agency. And so now we come with FSMA, and this is an interesting question for me. So the government now, the FDA now, is going in and looking at a company's food safety plan. And they're looking at that food safety plan and they're accepting it or they are rejecting it. Are they then assuming the responsibility for food safety that has historically resided with the manufacturer of the food?
I think
we're all in deep contemplation here.
I think not.
Yes. So it gave me cause to stop and think about it, because it is a little bit more hands on than we've ever been before with the regime to enforcing food safety. Before, the agency would go in and they would find a specific cause. Now they're going in and they're looking at a food safety plan, and the cause might not be so specific. It's just that the agency takes exception to the food safety plan. It's a philosophical question. I don't know that there is a correct answer, but I know that as a kid microbiologist coming into this industry, learning about food safety, that Keith Ito drilled into my mind that it was the responsibility of the people who make and market food, that food safety was their responsibility. So, I mean, I don't know if that has changed, but just a thought.
Mm-hmm. And an interesting thought at that. So that is, I think, maybe we'll leave it at that gap. There's a gap for you. We'll end on, that's a gap to end on. So this brings us to perhaps the most, important question of the three, and that is, has FSMA reduced outbreaks of foodborne illness?
So, you know, that's almost an impossible question to answer. So we, even anecdotal evidence isn't clear that FSMA has had an impact in reducing the incidences of food failures or food safety failures. So we go back on the numbers, and we're saying that there are, I think, some recent numbers suggesting that there are about 180,000 hospitalizations per annum in the United States due to foodborne illness. 3,000. 3,000 deaths per year. So, I go back to that paper that I wrote in 2013. And again, in 2013, we were saying that there were about 170,000 cases. And we were saying that there were about 3,000 deaths. I go back to that talk I gave in Connecticut in 1990, and in 1990 we were saying that perhaps the numbers of hospitalizations were about 200,000, and it was routinely accepted at that time that the fatalities were in the range somewhere between 5,000 and 10,000. So again, kind of looking over the years, there has been this trend line towards less fatalities, but the numbers of hospitalizations kind of remain the same. And then there are the viruses. We said that perhaps there are as many as 68 million cases of undiagnosed gastroenteritis in the United States per year. So we seldom factor these viral mediated foodborne illnesses into our data. So I don't know that FSMA has had this impact so far of causing fewer incidences, but I do want to go on the record and say that I do believe that when FSMA, as it's erected right now, and completely rolled out, will have the impact of improving the public health status of the food supply. I believe directionally this is the right thing, and that the outcome, improving the public health status of the food supply, will result. I'm on record as saying that proving food safety is almost impossible. It's almost impossible to prove food safety. There are too many risks. The risk population is so varied, but we can prove and we can validate the effectiveness of preventive control measures very effectively. Mm-hmm. So that's the difference. So then if we ask the question, Has FSMA improved food safety? I don't know that we can answer that one at all. If we operate on the assumption that proving food safety in the first instance is almost impossible.
That's an interesting thought. In response to the number of cases that you cite, I think playing the number game is difficult for a number of reasons. The first is, and I can speak for myself, the number of times I've had foodborne illness, I've never gone to the doctor. I think that most people, I mean, how many people, you know, unless it's really severe, don't even go. So I think case numbers are greatly underestimated. And I know that there are models to predict that, but I'm not a statistician, so I don't know the validity of those. But the other point, and this point is made by every single person I reached out to, our technologies for detecting outbreaks is so much better that confounds what, you know, so we can look at numbers and we see numbers increasing. Does that mean there are more outbreaks? No, it could mean that our methods for detecting them have increased. And we've talked about this before with Bob Ferguson on the podcast. You know, looking at the numbers alone is not sufficient to answer this question. Now, from Frank's point of view, who told me it was a great question and one of the most important. Thank you, Frank. I appreciate that.
I was just reading this, so I'm glad you're getting to this part of this. Awesome.
He thinks that most would agree that FSMA has resulted in safer food. I think because of what's been put in place at companies when they've implemented these additional controls. But he also recognizes that it's a race between the ability to detect and the ability to prevent. So maybe catching things early will prevent outbreaks. But he also brings up the issue of whole genome sequencing, and Steve Mondranoc brought this up as well. When you're detecting more of these outbreaks, you can then group them together. What we thought were isolated outbreaks, now we can cluster. The data is better that we can really have a lot more information to work with. So I think from Frank's perspective at FDA, one foodborne illness is one too many. And so he thinks that FSMA is helping to bend the curve, which is a line that we've heard a lot of over the past year. David Acheson also mentioned that to look at outbreaks, it's not a good indicator of success because of the, you know, confounding information with our ability to detect. Now, Kathy noted that one thing that she notices, she still gets all the recall notices, of course, and she's disappointed with the number of undeclared allergens still being really dominant in terms of recalls. And she had hoped that the parts of the PC rules that address food allergens would have made a big dent in that. So that's a little bit of a disappointment for her. But I really think that from my perspective, I think it has. But because we're seeing so many more outbreaks because of our ability to detect, it kind of muddies the waters a little bit.
Well, I know we're running out of time here, and I don't know that there's a well, Larry, I've been talking to you for 25 years. I could keep talking to you. So I know Barbara feels the same way. One of the things that I in hearing from our audience, we know that our audience spans you know, from those who are very new to the field to experts such as yourself. Larry, what would your advice be to someone since we're taking, you know, this is a big view. So for someone who's new, do you have any advice for the things that they can do or the way that they can approach or an approach to study or some words of wisdom?
Well, thanks, Stacy, for that question. Yeah, I look at my career and, I was really, really fortunate to start my career at the National Food Processors Association at the time that I did. At the time, the NFPA was the leading association supporting the production of human food. I mean, they were the class. And you know, so I learned in the laboratory about a whole raft of different foods and food products and what the problems for those food products were in the laboratory and how to test and seek out harmful bacteria as well as spoilage flora. But at the same time at NFPA, I had the great opportunity of being sent to the field as a troubleshooter to go into a food facility that was experiencing a failure, that was experiencing spoilage or were in the throes of a recall. And being able to go into the factory and learn how raw materials move from the front end of a food processing establishment across the expanse of the manufacturing operation to distribution and transportation. My point of differentiation in my career has been understanding the machinery on the floor in the food processing plant. How it operates, what its vulnerabilities are insofar as making safe food go. So to me, you come in with a basic understanding, a fundamental understanding of microbiology. You need to understand the bugs, because succinctly, Dr. George York, who was a professor at University of California, Davis, said that the bugs will always tell the story. And so you need that fundamental understanding of the microbes. But you also need to understand food processing equipment. What's the difference between a butterfly valve and a needle valve, and why is one better in one application as opposed to another? What's the difference between a positive displacement pump and a centrifugal pump, and why is one better in one application than in another? These are the nitty gritty nuts and bolts of food safety, and I would encourage any young folk who want a career in food safety, get into as many food processing plants as you can. Spend as much time on the floor in a food processing plant as you can. Understand that equipment. Understand its strengths, its weaknesses, its vulnerabilities. And in the end of the day, learn how to validate a food manufacturing process. This is the fundamental stuff of food safety science.
We could start a new major called food safety mechanic.
Food safety engineering.
So this is my book. The outline for my book chapters on my the chapters in my book are essentially what I've outlined here, and that's a reflection on my career. I think that we when we we distill down this idea of we make food safe, then all of those things that I just talked about go into making food safe. And I don't think that enough people understand that. Mm. Right?
Yeah. Well, there's a lot to know. And, you know, when you say food, right?
Yeah.
We've also talked about that there are the seven programs involved in FSMA. I mean, and each one of those, you know, involves just incredible amounts of knowledge and incredible amounts of intricacies. And I think that, you know, it's been a major undertaking. It continues to be a worthwhile pursuit and a progressive, you know, we will keep going on in the pursuit of FSMA. And there's a lot that has been laid out with the blueprint and the new era of smarter food safety. There's a forward view to the next 10 years of how we continue to perfect the art and the science of food safety and of ensuring the public health. Larry, I can't thank you enough for all that you share with us all the time, and for joining us today. And we look forward to the next time and that book.
Thanks for giving me the opportunity.
In addition to thanking Larry, of course, we also want to take the opportunity to thank Frank Yannis, Deputy Director of FDA, for sending in his comments and for his continued work. Frank's expertise has spanned manufacturing, retail, and now government, and he's certainly an incredible resource, and we're very, very lucky to have him in the seat that he's in now. Kathy Gombas, we want to thank Kathy for sending in her comments. We're so happy, Kathy. We know that we kind of caught you off guard with this, but we appreciate the fact that you are right in the details. You can always count on Kathy to get right to the heart of the details and be able to articulate that very quickly. Also, Dr. David Acheson for responding. We're very lucky to have people who are involved in implementing FSMA, both Kathy and David in the beginning, as well as, of course, Steve Mondernach with AFTO, who's a regular guest on our podcast. So thank you all for your participation. And of course, thanks to all of you for listening. You can find links to all the references that we've mentioned in the episode in our show notes. You can access those in your podcast player or on our website at foodsafetymagazine.com/podcast, then find episode 87. And please, never, ever hesitate. Send us questions and suggestions to podcast@foodsafetymagazine.com or post a note on Twitter, LinkedIn, or Facebook. You can make sure that new and bonus episodes magically appear in your feed by clicking, or if you're more in the mood, smash that subscribe button. And while you're there, take a moment and rate the podcast. You know, throw a few stars our way. It's good for everyone. All right. That's it for us today. Our next regular episode will post on January 26th. Take good care of yourselves and those around you, and we'll talk to you then.